This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. Today on the program, we are featuring a panel discussion held last week at the Hinckley Institute that focuses on the role of money in politics and the rules governing how a political candidate, nominee, or incumbent raises money to fund their election campaigns. Those rules include disclosing the names of individuals, organizations, and companies who donate to political campaigns, as well as the amount of money donated and how that money can be spent on campaigns. This comes after the 2010 Supreme Court decision on Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission, ruling that political spending is a form of free speech that's protected under the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. The Citizens United decision effectively allowed corporations, individuals, and organizations to collect and donate unlimited amounts of money to a political candidate so long as they did so independent of the campaign themselves. The title of today's forum is Campaign Finance Reform. Speaking on the panel, Robert Gerke, news columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune, Utah Republican Senator Todd Weiler of District 23, Virginia Lee from the Utah chapter of Move to Amend, a political organization seeking to amend the Constitution to declare money as not a form of free speech. And moderating today's panel is KUER's news reporter, Nicole Nixon.
This is a Hinckley Institute of Politics forum on campaign finance reform. We're going to be talking about the state of campaign finance reform and how it's changed since the Supreme Court ruling in Citizens United. The first question I have is, do you see, and I'll give each of you a few minutes to respond. I'll just ask the question, and we can go down the line if that works for everybody.
Sure.
Do you see any flaws in the current system of financing political campaigns, and if so, what are they?
All right. To answer the question, in May of 2015, a New York Times CBS News survey identified that 84% of Americans believe that money has too much influence in American political campaigns, and 85% believed that campaign finance is in need of fundamental changes. In 2015 and 16, the Bipartisan Policy Center, which is out of Stanford and New York University, conducted two national opinion surveys to assess what the public knows about campaign finance, how concerned the public is about the role money plays in the political system, and what, if anything, can be done about it. The survey results criticized the emergence of a shadow system in which campaign financing occurs in secret, how certain types of expenditures are counted makes a big difference in how Citizens United and Buckley v. Valeo play out, and whether reform will make any meaningful difference in the workings of democracy. And that was back in 2015 and 16, and we're worse off, folks, as you all know, than we were then. In 2013, in the course of successful efforts of Move to Amend Utah to work with the Salt Lake City Council to reduce mayoral campaign contribution limits from $7,500 to $3,500 and council limits from $1,000 to $500, the City Council conducted an opinion question poll where they sent a poll to all registered voters in Salt Lake City to determine what their opinion was with regard to campaign finance funding. Of the 19,906 who responded, 89% returned opinions agreeing that corporations are not people and money is not speech. Since Citizens United decision in 2010, new money has come largely from individuals and unions, with a very small share of campaign financing coming from corporations. The reason for that could be coincidental with the fact that in 2009, Brett Kavanaugh issued an opinion in Emily's List versus FEC, which basically conceived the idea of super PACs. And in 2010, the DC Circuit Court's decision in speechnow.org versus the FEC created super PACs. So the creation of super PACs coincided in 2010 with the Citizens United decision. And I will talk later about the pattern of spending, of contributions that has resulted from that. And lastly, in response to the question, until September 18, 2018, most attack ads were funded by 15 groups that accounted for more than 75% of the $800 million in undisclosed political dark money flowing to political nonprofit 501c4s and 501c6 organizations, and that $800 million was spent between January of 2010 and December of 2016.
So that's why I was glad you went first, because I think it gives a good lay of the land. I mean, you touch on the important, you know, Buckley, you touch on Citizens United. I think I would contend, let's talk about it from two different standpoints, right? You've got a federal system that right now is basically dysfunctional and broken. And you've got a state system that is a Wild West. And that's, I think somewhere between the two is probably where we want to be. At the federal level, the FEC doesn't work. There's a 3-3 divide on it. The former commissioners have said in the past that that the three Republicans always vote together against the three Democrats. And as a result, there's no enforcement of federal campaign laws. If there was enforcement of federal campaign laws, it doesn't really matter either, because since Citizens United, we've seen the emergence of dark money groups and spending of undisclosed amounts in a coordinated fashion. Before the ink was dry on McCain-Feingold, when that passed, they had already created a way to get around that. And I remember distinctly when I was working in D.C., I was sitting in a friend's kitchen talking with the a gentleman who worked for the Democratic National Committee at the time. And this was before McCain-Feingold had passed, but he was saying, it doesn't matter. We've already got a way around it. And sure enough, they did. They're two moves ahead, and you're always trying to chase, you know, you're trying to play the last game, right? And the politicians and the campaigns and the corporations are already two games ahead. At the state level, we're one of the very few states, Todd, maybe, you know, I think maybe the only state that doesn't have limitations on the amounts of contributions or limiting corporate contributions.
We will get to that. There are nine other states, but we'll get to
that.
There
we go. Thank you for that. So on that level, we're sort of the Wild West. Anything goes. Anybody can give any amount of money to any campaign. What we do have in this state that we maybe don't have at the federal level is at least some structure for disclosing that information. And so you kind of have to ask yourself, which way do we want to go? Do we want to put these limitations on that maybe don't work and there's ways around them? Or do we want wide open and full disclosure? And to be honest, I don't know the answer to that, because I've seen the efforts to try to regulate the money that comes into campaigns, and I've seen them consistently foiled by smarter attorneys and smarter campaign consultants and so forth. So, but yes, right now the system is broken. I don't think we know at the federal level who's funding campaigns, who's funding Senate campaigns, who was playing in our presidential campaign. And at the state level, I think the corporations and these unlimited corporate donations can be a major problem in terms of influencing our political system.
So first of all, let me say, I think we all want to live in a world where we feel like there's a level playing field, where we have an equal shot, an equal opportunity to get elected to office as everyone else does. None of us want to feel like the system is tilted against us and in favor of either the uber rich or whatever. So I share those values. I grew up in a family. My father dropped out of high school and worked as a janitor most of his life. I'm not uber wealthy, never tried to be, never will be. So none of us want to feel like the rules are against us. Now, with that said, we live in a world where money matters. We're sitting in a building
that has someone's name on it because he donated money. Your football stadium has two names on it because those families donated money. That's the world we live in. And I think Citizens United and even the U.S. Constitution recognizes the fact that the world is what the world is. And I want to respond to a couple of things. Number one, we had PACs before Citizens United, maybe not super PACs, but we had PACs. Money has always had an influence in politics, and it always will. We live in a country with a constitution, and our Supreme Court, which is the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. The U.S. Supreme Court gets to tell us what the Constitution means and what it doesn't mean. And one of the things they've told us it means is that money is free speech. Money equates free speech. And so if I give you $100 to run for student council at the U, that's one of the ways that I express my free speech. So what I want to just lay that foundation there. When we talk about telling people they can't, how they can spend their money when it comes to political messaging, whether it's for their own campaign, whether it's for a special interest or a super PAC, or whether it's to donate to someone else, we're telling them, we're placing a limitation on their free speech. What the U.S. Supreme Court recognized in Citizens United was that money was speech, and you can't tell private organizations how or how much they can spend to express their opinion. Now, one thing you know, Mr. Gerke said, but I want to elaborate on, it is illegal for a super PAC to coordinate their message with a candidate. If that's happening, that's against the law. People can be prosecuted for that. That's a criminal violation. And so Mr. Gerke just said, well, that's happening. We all know it's happening. Well, we don't know that's happening. If that's happening, there should be an investigation. There should be charges filed. There should be at least fines assessed. So let's look at our own state. We have a U.S. Candidate for U.S. Senate, Mitt Romney, and we have Jenny Wilson, whose father's sitting in the crowd. Both of them come from well-known, prominent families. One of them has a lot of money that, by the way, he earned most of himself. We have another senator, Mike Lee, who doesn't have a lot of money, but he grew up, as the son of Rex Lee, who was not only Solicitor General for the United States under President Reagan, I believe, but he was also president of BYU. So he had that going for him. We have Rob Bishop, who is a school teacher. We love to tell the story. We have a school teacher who was elected to Congress. He was also Speaker of the House of Representatives here on the state level, and he was a lobbyist made some money doing that before he was elected. We have Chris Stewart, who happened to be a New York Times best-selling author and the brother of a federal judge, Ted Stewart, here in the state. We have Mia Love, who kind of was a little bit of an enigma, being a black female Republican, and was the first black female Republican ever elected to Congress. And now we have John Curtis, who's multimillionaire, by the way, but also he was a very popular and successful mayor of Provo for 8 years before he was elected to Congress. And the reason I go through those, and then we have Governor Herbert, who, by the way, ran for governor and was polling eighth or ninth out of a field of 11, but then kind of hitched his wagon to John Huntsman, who is the son of a billionaire, was lieutenant governor until Huntsman went to China to become ambassador, and then has been able to get reelected as governor several times. And so you kind of, looking at that, that broad brush, you kind of need either some type of name recognition, or you need some type of money, or both, as in the case of Huntsman and Romney. But that's kind of what it takes. And I think I think if we want to blame someone for that, let's all look in the mirror, because ultimately we're the ones that are voting these people into office.
So to follow on that, what changes? We talked about flaws in the current system. What are there changes that any of you see? And I know that we're not going to solve the problem right here, but if you have ideas, let's hear them.
I will take a crack at it, and I think probably I've got about 4 pages of notes. I will respond first to what Todd said, that the Supreme Court interprets the Constitution, and what it says is the law. Well, folks, it is until you and I amend the Constitution. And the only way to get around Citizens United and the Wild West that it's created nationally is to amend the Constitution, and that's what Move to Amend is about. On the back table, there are brochures about Move to Amend. There is the proposed language of Move to Amend for a 28th amendment to the Constitution, effectively saying that corporations are not people and money is not speech. There are cards, business cards, with three questions on them you can ask candidates about dark money. So, with that, I will say, in relation to Move to Amend, in 2009, a group of 10 people, this is before Citizens United decision came down on January 21, 2010, a group of about 10 people, including Utah and Ashley Sanders, met in California in anticipation of the court's decision. Since then, the National Move to Amend Coalition was born. Nationally, there are 28 Move to Amend affiliates, 18 staff and board members, and interns from 9 states. And together, we have succeeded in securing 61 House sponsors of a proposed 28th Amendment, a resolution of representatives in the United States House of Representatives to amend the Constitution. Discussions are currently being held with a member of the United States Senate, whose name I don't know yet, who is considering stepping up to sponsor a resolution in the United States Senate. No Supreme Court case has ever held that a corporation is a person. It was merely a clerk of the court in 1886, the clerk having been a former railroad executive. The case was Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad Company. And the clerk, in the syllabus, which has no precedential effect whatsoever, wrote, "The defendant corporations are persons within the intent of the clause in Section 1 of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, which forbids a state to deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws." Since 1886, that case and the language in the syllabus, which has no precedential value, has been cited in 177 Supreme Court opinions for the proposition that corporations are people. And we've heard that from a candidate for the Senate. In Citizens United in 2010, the majority engaged in judicial activism to devise an argument elevating corporations above people, living, breathing people. That argument has two parts. The First Amendment protects associations of individuals in addition to individual speakers, and corporations are associations of individuals. Therefore, they have speech rights under the First Amendment. Further, because spending money is essential to disseminating speech, as established by Buckley v. Valeo in 1976, a corporation's ability to spend money, any restrictions on a corporation's ability to spend money is unconstitutional because it limits the ability of its members to associate effectively and to speak on political issues. Well, you and I, folks, we can vote, and corporations can't vote. In his dissent in Citizens United, Justice Stevens noted, "Corporations have no consciences, no beliefs, no feelings, no thoughts, no desires. Corporations help structure and facilitate the activities of human beings, to be sure, and their personhood often serves as a useful legal fiction. But they are not themselves members of we the people, by whom and for whom our Constitution was established. Many people feared and expected that the enhanced corporate personhood conferred by Citizens United would unleash unlimited corporate spending, but it didn't. I won't go into the corporate personhood arguments, but I do have handouts, which I found to be significant, identifying the pattern of spending that has resulted after Citizens United and after the coincidental creation of super PACs in 2010. So what to do? What to do? Well, okay, we've talked about amending the Constitution. That's one thing. I take my hat off, as does Mr. Gerke, to Justice Beryl Howell, a woman, on the D.C. Circuit, the chief judge of the D.C. Circuit. The chief judge of the D.C. Circuit, who issued an opinion. I will note that in Citizens United, 8 out of the 9 justices, everyone except Justice Thomas, agreed with part 4 of the decision in Citizens United that there is a need for disclosure of who is financing political speech. And Citizens United is good law. I respect part 4. We're not interested. Move to Amend is not interested in amending and eliminating that. And in fact, Move to Amend commends Judge Howell, whose decision in Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, also known as CRU, versus FEC, identified or invalidated an FEC regulation that since 1980 allowed donors to so-called dark money groups to remain anonymous. Nobody challenged it until CRU challenged it in 2016. A 2016 case, or at least it made its way to the D.C. Circuit in 2016, and that's its number. It's 136 pages. I'll pass it around. It is. I don't expect anyone to read it.
I would like to give these two a chance to respond. We're almost halfway through our time, and we have a bunch of more questions. So if you don't mind, just real quickly, Senator Wyler and Mr. Gerke, what changes would you like to see regarding campaign finance and the FEC?
Well, first of all, let me address the constitutional amendment. There's been over 10,000 attempts in our country's short history to amend the Constitution. Less than 30 of them has been successful. And when I say less than 30, it's really less than 20, because the first 10 were part of the Bill of Rights, which were enacted just 4 years after the Constitution passed, and it was almost a package deal. And so while I'm not trying to poo-poo any discussion of amending the Constitution, let's be realistic. You've got about an 18 out of 10,000 chance of that happening based on our history over the last 200 years and change. So the problem, and Mr. Gerke also successfully identified this in his first comments, is the problem is whatever regulation you dream up, there's always a way around it. So let's say you say, like we do in our federal races, your donations are capped at, let's say it's $3,000 or $2,888. Let's say they're capped, you know, for each phase of a federal race. So, but that's capped per individual. So that means I can donate that much if I have that money. My wife can donate that much. Each of my children, my parents, there's always, and my point is simple, there's always a workaround. And that's why you heard Mr. Gerke saying, as soon as this, you know, this McCain-Feingold, they're saying we've already found a way around it. And that's why I think Utah is actually doing it right. We are a disclosure state. As an elected official, I have to file within 10 days of receiving a campaign contribution I have to file that. And when it's right before the primary or the general election, that shrinks down to, I think, 3 days. I actually filed a report yesterday for the September 30th report. Even though I'm not up for re-election for 2 years, I still have to file a report like 4 times a year. And so everyone knows where my money's coming from. If any one of you give money, I have to disclose your name, your address. And so everyone knows. You can look online at le.utah.gov and see where the money's from. And in terms of there being no caps on that, I don't think I've ever received a donation of more than $3,000. That's a lot of money, and don't get me wrong. But Governor Herbert has received a handful of donations of $50,000 or so, and that's always on the front page of the newspapers like the Salt Lake Tribune. So everyone knows he's gotten that money, and then it can be up to the voters to decide if there's, you know, something expected in return for that. So I do think, with the understanding that there's always a way around the regulations, that making it transparent as possible is the right approach. And when we talk about transparency, we have a lot of organizations in this state that lobby the legislature on public policy, organizations like Alliance for Better Utah, Libertas, which is behind the marijuana Proposition 2. They will not disclose their donors. And so they're always talking about, oh, we need more transparency. Well, don't ask us to tell us who our donors are.
So the campaign contribution issue is one for years and years. I've been a big proponent of, or a believer, that campaign contribution limits would help improve the political process. And I've kind of moved away from that just because I've seen enough ways around those limitations, as Todd mentioned, that I think that disclosure is one of the more important issues we've got. Todd is right. The candidates, if I give money to Todd, it's going to show up on his campaign report. I haven't. I'm sorry. I'll get you the check at the end. But what we haven't seen, I think, is what we haven't seen as much of in the state as we've seen in other states is the dark money that comes in, the money from groups. And Todd mentions Libertas and mentions Alliance for Better Utah, but Americans for Prosperity has a Utah chapter that is funded by the Koch brothers. They have about a $93 million a year budget that they pump into these campaigns across the country, and we don't know, you know, who's funding that and what the agenda is. And they hide behind these different groups. Quickly, I'm sorry, geez, I'm gonna fall over. I brought a slide. I'm so proud of myself. This was an exhibit that was that came out during the investigation into Attorney General John Swallow back, I believe, in 2013 is when they finished this. And what you've got up at the top is the transparent money, which is money that, like Todd described, is money that goes directly from an individual to a campaign and then gets disclosed. What you've got in the middle is are these payday lending companies that sort of funded a PAC that's not quite as transparent as the transparent money. But the real problem we've seen is the hidden money. So you've got these payday lenders, and Swallow's consultant and Swallow himself said, it doesn't look good for me to be taking a lot of money during an election from payday lenders. So instead, why don't we give it to these other groups, Energy Alternatives, Inc., Proper Role of Government Education Association, which then gave it to the Proper Role of Government Defense Fund, or to It's Now or Never 501c4. And you can see how this ended up, they ended up running attack ads against Sean Reyes, who was John Swallow's opponent in the primary, and also against Brad Daw. Brad Daw was a state representative who had sponsored legislation to crack down on the payday lending industry. None of this was reported. I mean, there was no way, we knew there were ads that were running. We knew it was It's Now or Never, Inc. that was behind them, but we didn't know that the payday lenders were funding this, or that they had coordinated to set up this whole shell game to try to obscure the money that was there. Now, this is just one example of dark money that, you know, if you come to see the movie on tomorrow night that Virginia mentioned, it talks about how different groups had sought to influence the Montana elections. We've seen this in Wisconsin. If you read Jane Meyer's book, Dark Money, you see how these organizations set up this sort of impossible, impossibly opaque regime to try to obscure the money. And what, as Virginia mentioned, there was this ruling out of the D.C. Circuit that the Supreme Court declined to review, that gives Utah another chance at trying to shed some light on this. We had a bill that passed, I believe, in 2013 as a consequence of the Brad Daugh attacks that would have forced 501s to disclose their donors if they are involved in, engaged in political campaigns or political electioneering. That bill was challenged by, as Todd mentioned, Libertas and the Attorney General's office, Sean Reyes's office, declined to defend it. They said, we're not going to enforce it. But they paid Libertas $125,000 in taxpayer money for their legal fees, and then the next session got the legislature to repeal it. Based on this D.C. Circuit ruling and a similar ruling out of the Ninth Circuit, I think there's another window for us to start trying to shed some light on this sort of opaque, dark money scheme. So that's one of the solutions. Again, the campaign finance limits. I'm kind of a little bit down on those right now, mostly because of this. I think the more you push down on that, the more dark money, the more of it flows into dark money and finds a way around those limitations.
You are listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. On this program, as you might already know, we record and broadcast some engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them unedited, mostly in their entirety, as a public service. And today we are airing a panel discussion held last week on the state of money in politics following the 2010 Supreme Court Citizens United decision ruling that political spending is a form of free speech protected under the First Amendment. Here again is Nicole Nixon.
The Federal Elections Commission limits campaign contributions for individuals running on a federal level, but Utah is one of 11 states. Sorry, I misspoke earlier. Utah and 10 other states do not have limits for individual contributions for candidates for local and state offices. And I'm curious if you think that should change. Should Utah limit donations to candidates? I'm especially curious what Senator Wyler thinks of this as an elected official.
Well, I think I've already kind of addressed that. It wouldn't affect me because most of my donations are $100 here or $500 there. Occasionally I'll get $1,000. So it wouldn't affect me in my current position. So I'm not opposed to it. But like I said, as soon as you put a limit and put down the rules, there will be smarter people than me that will tell you exactly how to work around it. And that's, I think, the real problem. And by the way, I'm not a proponent of dark money. I don't like the dark money. I voted for the legislation that Robert alluded to. And we were told at the time by the ACLU, they were lobbying against us saying, if you guys pass this bill, there's gonna be a lawsuit and you guys are gonna lose. And they were right, unfortunately. But there is now, like he said, there is some case making its way to the Supreme Court on this dark money issue. But and that pattern up there, that the slide that Mr. Gerke showed you, that was because there was a criminal trial as a result of all of that dark money. And so that is ostensibly, I believed what they did was illegal. The defendant both defendants in those trials ultimately were not convicted. But we saw emails that were produced in the House investigation of Mr. Swallow that showed exactly what Mr. Gerke said. It's going to make me look bad if all of these payday lenders are donating to my campaign, so let's hide the money in this complicated scheme. That is wrong. I think it's unethical. It should be illegal if it's not already. I think it is. And I'm not defending that. But I think you're right. The more artificial regulations you put, the more you encourage people to try to find a back channel.
Citizens United Part 4 identified the need for disclosure. 8 out of 9 of the justices agreed. Judge Howell's decision that came down on August 3rd had 45 days for it to remain in place. There was a little bit of tap dancing at the Supreme Court, and the unanimous Supreme Court declined to review that case, which means Disclosure is the law of the land. If the Supreme Court doesn't touch it, it's okay. The law is good. So I wanted to clarify that. What else can be done? I talked a little bit about what happened in Salt Lake City about reducing campaign contribution limits. Haven't had any follow-up with the city council to know what the effect of that is, but I will say that public campaign financing is on the ascendancy in the United States. As of February 2018, 13 cities, Albuquerque, Austin, Boulder, Long Beach, Los Angeles, New Haven, Oakland, San Francisco, Santa Fe, Seattle, Tallahassee, and Tucson, sounds like a train calling a train, and three counties, Hawaii, Miami-Dade, and Montgomery County, Maryland, have publicly funded elections, and 17 states, Alaska, Arizona, Connecticut, Florida, Massachusetts, Maryland, Maine, Michigan, Montana, North Carolina, New Mexico, Ohio, Oregon, Rhode Island, Virginia, and West Virginia have statutes that expressly allow for public campaign financing. Nothing in the Utah Election Code prohibits public campaign financing. In fact, seven election code statutes arguably permit a public entity like a county or a city or a municipality to develop public campaign financing. One of those statutes, Utah Code Section 20A11-1206-3, broadly supports the concept of permitting public campaign financing and states. Nothing in the election code in this chapter prohibits a public entity from the neutral encouragement of citizens to vote. Our voting rate in Utah is what, 37%? 37%. People have given up because dark money, until disclosure this month, has been like a cancer on the political system of the United States. And again, dark money is going to see its end. And there are ways around dark money.
You are listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. In this final segment, the panel members take questions from the audience of faculty and students.
And also, thank you. You've been very illuminating. I'm very curious, as you've talked about different states doing different things with their financing. Utah does not have publicly elected judges, but we do have publicly elected attorney generals. And I was wondering, as Senator mentioned, that financing restructuring would affect different campaigns in different ways. There's been a cry over the United States in general for a shift from publicly financed to not even elected judges in the first place. Now, I'd like to know what the panel feels, how they feel about a transition from elected judges and elected attorney generals to publicly selected or, basically people who don't have to campaign or get ad or contributions to their campaigns that might influence them when making decisions.
Yeah, I think that was one of the issues that Senator Wyler was contemplating after the Swallow investigation and the fallout from that. Because you have a law enforcement officer who's out raising tens of thousands of dollars, in some cases more, or has back-channel money, the dark money that I showed earlier, coming in, and how does that influence their decision-making in terms of prosecution and whether who they charge, who they don't charge. I think it's a good idea to have the Attorney General appointed by the governor. And while that doesn't eliminate a conflict necessarily, because the governor also then has issues about who's funding his campaigns, it's not as direct. And I also, you know, it would follow roughly the federal model. Now, that doesn't mean there's no friction, because we've obviously seen some of the friction between President Trump and Jeff Sessions, right? But it also just means that the Attorney General is not out hustling for dollars when he's trying to make decisions on who to charge. And there's not influence on what cases he stays out of either. I mean, you've got, as we've talked about with the corporate contributions, is he then afraid to step up? Another issue that I have with the funding for the Attorney General's race is you have these umbrella organizations, the Republican Attorney General's Association, the Democratic Attorney General's Association, that were the top funders of Sean Reyes's campaign last time. I think they gave him $250,000, which is a lot of money for a state race in Utah that's not even very competitive, frankly, right? I mean, he won it his opponent dropped out, and I think he won with 75% of the vote. So those, you get away from that if you have the Attorney General appointed rather than elected.
Yeah, I agree. I actually ran a bill in 2013 that would have asked to, you know, put on the Constitution a ballot question to change our Attorney General to appointed. And Robert mentioned that that's the federal model. None of us voted for Jeff Sessions or Eric Holder or any of those Attorney Generals. I was going to say Janet Reno, but not because the president, who is elected by the, you know, Electoral College, then gets to pick his Attorney General. But in most states, I think there's only 7 states that don't elect the Attorney General. We have gone to an elected position. We used to elect our judges in Utah, and that changed sometime after the mid-70s. I'm not sure the year. But one of the judges that was elected and then was retained once we changed our system, his last name was Uno. And he ran in an area, I think West Valley, where there's a lot of Hispanic population. And so the Spanish translation of the ballot said vote for one, which is vote for Uno. And then his name was right there against his opponent. And he won overwhelmingly because the ballot said vote for Uno, which was kind of a funny little asterisk in Utah. But now that we don't elect our judges, and I won't bore you, but I'm the chairman of the Judicial Confirmation Committee in the Senate, so I have a role in how our judges, our 129 state judges, are appointed. We are now held up across the nation as the best model for selecting judges and one of the best judicial benches. In Texas, they still elect their judges, and you actually have lawyers appearing before the judges donating to their campaigns, law firms donating their campaigns. It's a horrible way to run a state, and I hope we never go back. Now, when it comes to the Attorney General, and I'll tell you quickly why I ran the bill, and I it didn't pass, but the thing is the Attorney General is a prosecutor, but as Robert alluded to, he's also making, or she's making, in the terms of Jane Graham, quasi-judicial decisions, because they're ultimately deciding who to file charges against and who to say, well, I don't think the evidence is there. And so you have the police agencies, they go out and gather the evidence, and the FBI is this way too, and then they bring it to the prosecutors and say, here's everything we found, and then it's the prosecutors that decide, okay, we're going to file charges or we're not going to file charges. And the allegations against Shurtleff and Swallow, who are our two most recent former attorney generals, were that the very companies that they should have been prosecuting or at least investigating were the ones that were making the biggest donations to them. And these national organizations that Robert alluded to, if you look at the last 10 years, even the last 20 years, the amount of money flowing to the attorney general races from the big pharma, who right now we're suing in the state of Utah, but it took us like a year longer to get that lawsuit filed than what the legislature wanted. Those are the ones that are funneling money to these Republican and Democratic attorney general's organizations, and then that money that then gets turned around and given to the candidates. Why does nobody in Utah donate to the state treasurer's race, which is a statewide election, or the state auditor's race? Those guys raise, if they're lucky, less than $30,000. But attorney general and the governor, those guys are raising hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars. And they're all, you know, if you're a good Republican and you want to support good Republican candidates, they're all running as Republicans in Utah in a statewide race. But no, everybody knows the treasurer and the auditor can't do anything for you. So if you're only donating because you think ultimately that person could do something for you, what is the attorney general doing for you? And that's why I think it should be appointed.
Ergo, you can buy votes. I commend Representative Wyler, and I have a question for you, Todd. Given Part 4 of Citizens United strongly advocating disclosure, and given Judge Howell's decision this month about disclosure in federal races, are you willing to sponsor and submit before the session begins a bill in the Utah House of Representatives requiring disclosure in accordance with Citizens United and Judge Howell's decision?
Well, I just mentioned about 10 minutes ago, I voted for that very bill in 2013, and then it was, we paid $125,000 in attorney's fees because we got sued for that bill, which is exactly what the ACLU said. I can't sponsor a bill in the House of Representatives because I am in the Utah Senate, but I've always been in favor of people disclosing who they are, and I think Alliance for Better Utah and Libertas and the other organizations should also have to disclose their donors, so I'm always been in favor of that kind of transparency.
We have time for one or two more questions if there are any students or people in the audience that have questions for the panel.
You know, at the philosophical core of all of this is how speech became money and how business organization became individuals. And I don't know those cases. I haven't read them all. How did the courts defend those immense transitions? Because I think it really brings the whole thing to question. And is there something you could tell me about the opinions of the court that they made those leaps?
I think I'm qualified, perhaps, to answer that. And it is my perception, after having practiced law for 38 years and having observed courts and having observed Supreme Court decisions and having currently observed the nomination that's in question. And that is that judges are minted the same way you and I are minted, by our experiences and by what we've learned. And every judge brings to any decision that judge makes their own, the law, and their own experience. And if their own experience is such that it would overrule existing law, and they're not comfortable with existing law, they'll do it. In Citizens United, Justice Roberts, in his concurring opinion, expressly addressed that there are occasions where judges will simply overrule precedent and do what they want to do. And that's why a 5-4 Supreme Court is a dangerous proposition.
Todd, do you know the background of the Buckley versus Vallejo? And you may know it better than I do.
I am a lawyer. I don't know that off the top of my head. I wasn't right. Prepared for that. So.
We may not have the legal firepower to answer that question.
But I will say this. I think it's, let's be careful what we wish for, because corporations pay taxes. Corporations get criminally charged and the principals go to jail. And so if we're going to say that, I mean, and right now, we, as has already been pointed out, corporations can't vote. And so if we're going to start trying to pull on that thread to say corporations aren't people, I'm not sure where that it doesn't unravel the whole sweater. Because, you know, corporations don't have Social Security numbers, but they have EIN numbers. And so there's a lot of ways that we treat corporations like people in the tax code and the criminal code. And so I would just say, be careful what you wish for.
And I take a different opinion on this one, not surprisingly, from Todd. But corporations are groups of people, but they're made up of people, right? I mean, Todd and I get together, form a corporation, you know, Todd Corp or whatever, it's still us. We're still people, and we can still contribute, and we can still vote, and we can still speak. That doesn't mean the corporation suddenly gets to speak as well. And so I think when you start projecting those rights of the individuals that associate and form the corporation onto a corporation itself, you start moving away from, you start amplifying the speech of the corporation above the speech of the individuals who make up the corporation.
But again, if we're a C corporation, the corporations pays taxes, and then when we get distributions to shareholders, we pay a second tax on the same money. So again, be careful what you wish for.
Nowhere in the United States Constitution does the word corporation appear. Corporations are creatures of states. States can regulate corporations, however, states are inclined to regulate corporations. And when the citizens wish for something different, We have to stand up and fight for it.
And she's right. I'd like to also point out, nowhere in the Constitution does the word privacy or abortion appear, but we're pretty well settled on Roe versus Wade. And so that's not really the standard.
Looking at the 2018 election, Mia Love has come under a lot of fire for her current campaign finance collection. So maybe, Robert, could you go into some of that and why it's so problematic?
Yeah. So what happened is, under the federal guidelines, you're able to donate $2,700 per election to a candidate. And so in the Utah system, we have at the convention election, that's considered an election, a primary election, and the general election. So that's three. So everybody can give 27 times three. My math's not good, but I believe that's $8,100 each. So Mia Love went out and raised $8,100 from all of these individuals, even though she knew that she wasn't going to have a primary because she didn't have an opponent. And so what the FEC has said is that you don't get to count that towards your total. You need to refund the money. She's reallocated a portion of it. I believe she raised $1.1 million that they said, she raised $1.1 million for a primary she knew she wasn't going to have. They said you need to refund that. I think she's reallocated something like $300,000. And so she's going to be keeping the rest of it, is what she says. And so we've run into this before. Mike Lee had a similar issue on a much, much smaller scale. But here's the problem. Again, like I said at the outset, the FEC doesn't work. So there's really no way, you can mark my words on this, there's no way that they're going to ever take any action against her before the election. So she'll have already spent the money. She'll have won or lost the election, and then she'll deal with the consequences then. But if there are any consequences anytime down the road, because again, the FEC doesn't work. So that's why it's problematic. I think, you know, it's obviously, Utah has a unique system, and it's caused problems before, but just nowhere near on this scale.
And let me just give you the rest of the story. Anyone in this room, any registered voter in Utah, could have filed against Mia Love up until March 15th or so of this year. Mitt Romney didn't know he was going to have an opponent until Mike Kennedy filed. And so I don't think it's fair to say that she was raising money for a primary she knew she wasn't going to have. And by the way, Jim Matheson did the exact same thing that Mia Love did and paid a fine and paid it back. This is common in Utah because of our unique election system, but it's being used as a campaign tactic against Mia Love for something that a lot of candidates in Utah have done. And had she had if she really wanted to play the system, she could have gotten someone to file against her on March 15th, and then she would have been able to keep all the money. So let's be fair.
Well, but this is, if I'm not mistaken, I believe the issue is the money that she raised between March 15th and July, June 26th.
It's money that she raised for 2 years. It's not just that.
It's not just that, but that's the part that she's refunding, I guess, as opposed to reallocating. So anyway.
That's Salt Lake Tribune News columnist Robert Gerke. The title of today's forum is Campaign Finance Reform and was held last week at the Hinckley Institute of Politics. If you would like to hear the full discussion, you can find it on our website, kcpw.org. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Christian Camargo, your producer and host of this program. As always, thanks for listening.